So speaking of invoking the Lord of Great Compassion, I talk now on the fourth of the ordination acceptance verses. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So I'm going to start with a short personal recollection. And it's a recollection of the day of my own public ordination ceremony. So still fresh in my mind, only last year. And the day of the public ordination ceremony was a particularly fine day. So this was coming after 2 weeks of quite wild weather. So strong winds rushing through the valley, rains, even some thunder on some occasions. But the day of the public ordination ceremony itself, the weather changed. So the clouds dispersed and the sun was beaming through. And the shrine room at Guhyaloka on that day was just looking particularly beautiful. And it was full of people. So there was myself and there were 19 other men who were joining the order on that day. And also in the room there are about 10 to 15 private preceptors, the four public preceptors who were conducting the ceremony, and then the order members as well of the Guhyaloka support team. It's a really full shrine room. And the strongest memory that I have of the day, and the most powerful moment in the ceremony, for me speaking personally, was the moment where we recited the four acceptance verses. So I do actually remember saying them. And in particular, it was the fourth verse that moved me. So for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. And it moved me because it's such a high ideal. And I was actually saying these words. I could almost feel the words coming up and out of my mouth. So this high ideal being expressed in that way, making this personal and individual commitment. But it wasn't just that, it was also moving because, as I said, there were 19 other men joining the order on that day, and they were all saying the same thing at the same time. So it was amplifying this high ideal being expressed. And not only that, we were being witnessed by the other preceptors and other order members in the room who themselves had made exactly that same individual and personal commitment and joined the order at that time saying those verses. So that just made it all the more weighty. So I think it was a particularly powerful moment because, as I say, there was this individual and personal aspect to it. I was saying the words, but also it was collective. Other people were saying it and joining the order, and other people there who'd also said it. So what I'd like to do in the talk is just to draw out those two aspects, draw out the significance of those two aspects of the fourth acceptance verse, of all the verses, but of the fourth acceptance verse in particular. And to do that as a way of trying to establish more fully what the order is. So that's what I'll do in the first part of the talk. But in the second part of the talk, I'd like to look more practically at how we actually put that fourth vow, to call it that, into practice. So how do we actually act as order members and as an order for the benefit of all beings? How do we express that? How do we live that out in our lives? So first of all, then I'll say something about the individual and personal aspects of this fourth acceptance verse. So it's stating the obvious, I know, but it is something that we say. It's something that we say out loud. And we express it with our own unique voice. And we're committing ourselves to what I say is a high ideal. And we're doing that in the context of a ritual and a ceremony. So all of that suggests that this is something really important, really significant, and something we should take really seriously. So if you want to join the order, if you have joined the order, a question that we can ask ourselves is, well, do we really believe what we'll be saying? Or do we believe what we've said? Do we believe that it's possible to live a life that's of benefit to all beings? So can we take the fourth vow seriously, or will we just say it but regard it as something poetic, something sentimental, you know, a nice idea, but ultimately something that is impossible to live up to? Will we just regard it as an optional extra? So I think we might be forgiven for thinking that the fourth verse is a bit far-fetched. It is quite a stretch, isn't it, to think of living a life that would be of benefit to all beings. And especially so when we look out on the world, we look out at the world of living beings, and what we see, we probably see all kinds of things, but what we definitely see is suffering. So we see suffering, all types of suffering, and suffering on a massive scale. So I don't keep up to date particularly well with the news, but I am aware that in the past 6 months in particular, there have just been some horrific examples of human suffering. So people suffering due to extreme violence or extreme kind of tragic accidents. So there's all that kind of suffering going on. That's just in this country, but all over the world. And in addition to that, there is the suffering of sickness, of death. And then there's the everyday suffering. There's even what appears to be quite trivial suffering, like Arthur Priya's example of somebody with the walnuts at breakfast time banging them next to him every day. I mean, that's dukkha too. So we have suffering all these different ways, and as I say, on quite a massive scale. And the Buddha summed that up, of course, really well in the what's known as the first discourse, so the all-encompassing nature of suffering. So he said to the five ascetics, his five friends at the deer park in Isipatana, that there was this noble truth of suffering, the first noble truth. And he said that birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Association with the loathed is suffering. Dissociation from the loved is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates affected by clinging are suffering. So when we look at the world of living beings, this is what we see. We see suffering. And we don't just see it externally, we see it. Or we feel it ourselves, we experience suffering ourselves. And if we can bear to keep looking, what we also see is that the roots of that suffering run very, very deep. And again, to quote the Buddha from the same sutta, he talks about the second noble truth, the origin of suffering. So the origin of suffering is craving, which produces renewal of being, is accompanied by relish and lust, relishing this and that. In other words, craving for sensual desires, craving for being, craving for non-being. So craving is at the root of all this suffering that we see in the world. Another way of expressing that would be to say greed, hatred and delusion, the three root poisons. And we see them, don't we, depicted in the centre of the wheel of life, at the hub of the wheel of life. And that's not just an image, it's not just something that sits outside the shrine room, it's a lived experience, a lived reality for millions, billions of living beings. So in the face of all that, in the face of all that suffering, in the face of the first two noble truths, we might be forgiven for thinking that the fourth acceptance verse, as I say, is quite a stretch. So something we might say, but not really take seriously. So we could do that. We could take it like that. We could take it in that spirit. But if we choose to do that, it's going to be problematic for us. It'll be problematic for us, firstly, because we know that that suffering is out there. We can turn away from it. We can try to turn away from it. We can try to block it out. But ultimately, we know it's out there. We know that the world suffers. So if we try to block it out and shield ourselves off from it, essentially what we're doing is blunting our own consciousness. We're blunting our own sensitivity. We're isolating ourselves from others, and that's a lonely place. But we'll also have a problem if we do that, if we turn away from suffering, because that would constitute a rejection of the whole of the Buddhist tradition. Yeah. So the importance of compassion for the world runs through the whole of the Buddhist tradition. So it's there right from the beginning, isn't it, in the immediate aftermath of the Buddha's enlightenment. So the Buddha's sitting there, enjoying his enlightenment, enjoying the subtlety of it, the profundity of it. But he's also aware of how likely it is that people will not be able to understand it, that it will be difficult for people to understand. And at that point, the Brahma Sahampati emerges, and he pleads with the Buddha, asks the Buddha to teach. He says there are those with little dust in their eyes who will be able to understand if given the opportunity. And the Buddha looks out on the world. He sees all that suffering, but he also sees the potential. So he sees that beings are like lotuses, has this vision of the lotus lake, sees that just like lotuses grow out of the dirt and turn into beautiful flowers, human beings can grow out of that suffering, out of dukkha, and towards enlightenment. And he goes, Brahma Sahampati knows that he's going to teach, he goes off, he finds those five friends at the deer park at Isipatana, and he teaches them, communicates enlightenment to them. And he doesn't just tell them the first two noble truths, does he? He doesn't just tell them that the suffering and the origin of suffering is craving. He tells them that there's an end to suffering. It is possible, and there's a way leading to the end of suffering. And then there's that beautiful moment where Kondanya knows, he gets it. Enlightenment has been communicated. It is possible to do that. And shortly after, there are a number of enlightened disciples, enlightened followers of the Buddha. And what does the Buddha do? But he sends them out into the world, says, go now and wander out of compassion for the world. So the Pali Canon definitely contains these indicators that one can and one should show concern for the suffering of the world. And the Mahayana Sutras, which emerged later, they give this even more emphasis. So even more emphasis on altruism. The bodhisattva ideal is made explicit and becomes paramount. So one pursues enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Even one stays in the world for limitless time, performing limitless virtues to liberate limitless numbers of beings. It's taken to that kind of level. And we get a flavour of that, the bodhisattva ideal, in the Bodhicharyavatara Puja, which we did last night. So those verses like, may I be medicine for the sick, may I be their doctor and their nurse until the sickness does not recur, etc. So given the prominence then of altruism in the Buddhist tradition, and the fact that we know that the world suffers, we have to take that fourth acceptance verse seriously. It's not just a throwaway comment. It's not an optional extra. So we take the word seriously, and we take this on as an individual, personal commitment to living in accordance with that vow. Nobody else is going to do it on our behalf. But there is a danger in this. So there is a danger in taking that vow seriously, that we go too far to the other extreme. So we take the vow seriously, but we try to live for the benefit of all beings in an unintelligent and unrealistic way. So we can turn that into some kind of self-referential fantasy. And Bhante has urged us to avoid this. So he's talked about developing an intelligent perspective on the bodhisattva ideal. And in speaking about the bodhisattva ideal on an ordination course in Tuscany in 1982. So I said that as if I was there. It's a year before I was even born. It's written down. He said this. So he said on that course, I see less and less the Bodhisattva vows as an individual thing in the ordinary sense. If you take some of the Bodhisattva vows seriously, you cannot, if you've got the least scrap of imagination, imagine yourself as an individual ever carrying them out. Something different is clearly involved. So what is that something different? So what is it that enables us to avoid these two extremes that I've described? So avoiding dismissing that it's even possible to live a life that's of benefit to all beings, and the other extreme of seizing upon that and turning it into a self-referential fantasy. What is that something different? Well, I think the short answer is the order. So the order, or one way of defining what the order is to say that the order is the means by which we can seriously, but also intelligently, live a life that's of benefit to all beings. So when we join the order and we recite that fourth acceptance verse, we are making a personal and individual commitment to benefiting all beings. So we're not dismissing the altruistic dimension of the Dharma life. But it's not just a personal commitment. So in the context of ordination, we make that commitment with others. We make it with others and we're witnessed by others who've also made that same commitment. So in theory, we avoid also turning this into some kind of self-referential fantasy. So the saying of the fourth verse then, as I've said, it has this individual but also this collective aspect. I think this is a really profound revisioning of the Bodhisattva ideal that Bhante has taught, emphasised. And to help to communicate something of the profundity of it, he's often invoked the image of the 11-headed, 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. So another quote here. The order, and especially the unity of the order, is symbolized by the figure of the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. Each order member represents one of those 1,000 arms and hands, joined on to the body of Avalokiteshvara. Each hand holds a single implement, a flower, wheel, vase, bow and arrow, and so on. Each instrument represents the particular activity of each individual order member. They represent the particular talent or gift that each individual order member makes to the order, to the movement, to the world as a whole. But all those symbols, all those implements, all those hands, all those arms, all those heads are integrated into this one figure, the body of Avalokiteshvara, which is the order. So that's Bhante's reading then of the Bodhisattva ideal. And he said as well, hasn't he, that the bodhicitta is more likely to arise in the context of a community. And just staying with the myth of Avalokiteshvara for a little bit longer, if people know the myth in more fullness, whereby Avalokiteshvara takes that vow to liberate all beings from suffering. He makes this vow and he says that if he ever falls back from that, if he ever has a selfish thought, may he shatter into pieces. And of course he then works tirelessly over many eons to work for the benefit of all beings. And then when he looks at the world again, he sees that there's just as much suffering. He has the selfish thought, thinks maybe there's no point, and he shatters into all these pieces. And at that point the Buddha Amitabha descends and reconstructs Avalokiteshvara with the 11 heads, and the thousand arms. So that myth has these aspects to it, these ingredients to it that we've just been looking at. So it has the kind of unintelligent, naive application or naive aspiration that one can do this all on one's own. Then there's the moment of doubt and the dismissal, and that leads to the shattering, the rebirth beyond something merely individual. And maybe, just maybe, the reason why the public ordination ceremony was so powerful, because there was something of a reflection of a reflection of a reflection of this in the air on that day in the public ordination ceremony. Something whereby we got a sense of being there as individuals and committing, but also being more than individuals at the same time. So just to summarise what I've said so far then, this fourth verse is something that I think we can take seriously. The altruistic dimension is integral to ordination and to Dharma life. But we also have to take it on intelligently. And the order provides a context in which we can do that. So we take on an individual responsibility, but we're not solely responsible. We work collectively as an order to be of benefit to all beings. So I want to start talking a bit more practically now. So how do we actually do that? How do we put that into practice? How do we act for the benefit of all beings? And I think to answer that, there's an even more fundamental question to address first, which is, what is of benefit to all beings? What actually is of benefit to all beings? So I've talked about suffering and the causes of suffering, and how the unenlightened human condition is one of suffering. And when we look at that, it's clear that people are not content with that situation. People are not content with suffering. So it might be that people are not aware of the nature of the existential situation. But nevertheless, on a deeper level, there is discontent. Satyaraja mentioned this existential dukkha. On a deeper level, there is this existential dukkha. And what we do in response to that, what human beings do, it's very human, is we employ various strategies to try to move away from suffering and towards satisfaction. So that involves grasping certain things, pushing away other things. And that's exhausting, and that just heaps suffering upon suffering. So we're all trying to find refuges. We're all trying to find refuges in things, in situations, in people. Refuges that can never actually satisfy us on a deeper level. And there are these lines in the Dhammapada in the chapter on the Enlightened One. Many people, out of fear, flee for refuge to sacred hills, woods, groves, trees and shrines. In reality, this is not a safe refuge. In reality, this is not the best refuge. Fleeing to such a refuge, one is not released from all suffering. So we're all in the rather fortunate position of knowing that there is an alternative to that. So we still go for refuge to things that can't satisfy us. I know I do. But at least we know that there is an alternative to that. At least we're aware of the possibility of going for refuge to the three jewels. We've made a connection with the three jewels. And as the Buddha says again in the Dhammapada, he who goes for refuge to the Enlightened One, to the truth and to the spiritual community, and who sees with perfect wisdom the Four Noble Truths, For him this is a safe refuge. For him this is the best refuge. Having gone to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So presumably we all believe this, at least at some level. We all either have or want to commit our lives to the three jewels, to going for refuge on deeper and deeper levels to the three jewels. So we see the three jewels as offering a safe refuge, the best refuge. We see that which moves us towards enlightenment and frees us from suffering as the best refuge, the best way to live. And if that's the case for us, it must also be the case for everybody else as well. Because ultimately, everybody else is in the same human predicament as we are, faces the same existential situation as we do. So when we ask that question, what is it that's of benefit to all beings? The answer has to be going for refuge to the three jewels. And that doesn't mean that everybody has to be a Buddhist in a kind of superficial sense. It doesn't mean that everybody has to be ordained into our order or anything like that. It certainly doesn't mean that we have to go out and forcibly convert everybody to Buddhism and hit people over the head with the Dharma. We've got to remember the words of the Tiratnavandana that we chant in the morning. And in the Tiratnavandana it says that the Dharma is of the nature of a personal invitation. So it is chosen freely by people. The Dharma life is chosen freely. And we also need to be clear about what's meant by the Dharma here. So I'm not talking superficially. This goes right to the heart of things. It goes right to the heart of what is the Dharma. So Bhante says in the Survey of Buddhism, in the section on the greatness of the Buddha, he says that the Buddha's teaching is not one way to enlightenment among many. It is the way, with capital letters. It's not one way among many, it is the way. Which I take to mean that it is for everyone. And he stresses that he's not saying that out of sectarian bigotry. He's saying that because ultimately the Dharma states the universal laws in accordance with which a human being becomes enlightened. So the Dharma states the universal laws in accordance with which a human being becomes enlightened. So the Dharma lays out the conditions upon which enlightenment depends. So in talking about the Dharma being of benefit to all beings, we're talking at this level. So the Dharma is that which leads towards enlightenment. And therefore the Dharma is the only safe refuge. The Dharma is the best refuge. It is the way, as Bhante puts it. So in order to be of benefit to all beings, to benefit all beings, we need to offer, we need to become even, the conditions on which they can move towards enlightenment. And I'm going to speak about three ways specifically in which as an order we can do this. So three things, and they're on three different levels. And I'll start with the deepest level first. So the first one might come as a bit of a surprise, But the order can be of benefit to all beings simply by existing. So the most beneficial thing we can do for the world is to keep the order, the spiritual community, in existence. And we're not actually obliged to do anything else. In Human Enlightenment, Bhante says, the spiritual community does not have to justify its existence to the world. It does not have to show that it brings about social and economic improvements, that it's helpful to the government or the administration. It does not have to show that it benefits the world in a worldly sense. And then he goes on to say, it is good for the world that such a thing as the spiritual community should simply be there. It's good that there should be people around who are dedicated to the spiritual life, dedicated to the development of skillful states of mind. This is good because it helps to develop a more wholesome atmosphere in the world. So I think what Bhante is suggesting here is that if there is a genuine Sangha, if there's a genuine spiritual community, that is a community of people going for refuge to the three jewels, that in itself is beneficial. Because without it, there's nothing to look up to. So we've already looked at the Garava Sutta in the retreat, and we've talked about loyalty to teachers and the importance of having people to look up to. But I think we can also look at that on a societal level as well. So just as the Buddha said, it's painful for a person to have nobody to look up to. It's painful for a society not to have a community to look up to. We could look at it on that level. So the order then can be a model community in that sense. So we can show what's possible, that it's possible to live together on the basis of a common commitment to a transcendental ideal, and to pursue that in harmony with one another. And this in itself will be of benefit to the world. So of course there are difficulties with that. So one of the difficulties is that we just settle down. You know, we've been ordained, we're in the order, the order's great for the world, so therefore we don't have to do anything anymore. So of course we need to avoid that. But the other problem is, if it's going to be a benefit to the world, it has to remain as a genuine Sangha, a genuine spiritual community. So we need to do all of the things that we've heard about in the last three nights' talks. So we need to maintain loyalty to our teachers and put the teachings into practice. We need to try to move towards a deeper and deeper harmony with each other. We need to be more like the Aniruddhas, blending like milk and water, and less like the quarrelsome monks of Kasambi. And we always need to keep in mind the transcendental ideal. We always need to keep enlightenment in mind, entering into that stream of creativity and positivity that Satyaraj talked about, and going beyond that, beyond what we can currently imagine and conceive. And if that's the case, if we can keep doing that as a community, as an order, we can offer something to the world, something to look up to. So the second way in which the order can benefit the world is by offering a bridge. So offering a bridge between itself and the world. So if we are a genuine spiritual community, then we'll want to do this. We'll want other people to benefit from what we benefit from and enjoy what we enjoy. So we're all fortunate in that we have discovered the Dharma. We've made a connection with the order and with the movement. And we could do that because there was a bridge. There was a bridge between where we were and the Sangha. And it's probably a person, for most people, probably a person that they meet and connect with. So he or she might have been a rickety old bridge, or not to mention any names. Bit bumpy or slippery in places, definitely not mentioning any names, but nevertheless we found a bridge into the Sangha. There's many people there in the world who haven't found that yet. I think Bhante once said that 1 in 10 people were possibly receptive to the Dharma. Even so, 1 in 10 is still millions of people, isn't it? So these are millions of people who could, who are ready, who are looking, but they haven't found that bridge yet. And as I've said, people are going for refuge already. People are looking for refuges, are looking for security in this insecure world that we inhabit. But they're not going to find it in the world. They'll only find it by transcending the world, so to speak. So we can offer a bridge for people to do that. We can offer them a way into the community of Dharma practitioners aspiring to go for refuge on deeper and deeper levels. So how do we do that then? How do we offer a bridge to people? Well, I don't think it's rocket science. I think it's more straightforward than we might imagine. So again, another recollection from Guhya Loka. There's a lot of energy there, a lot of really positive energy, a lot of inspiration. And we would often go out for walks together in the afternoons and come up with all these schemes to ways in which we could benefit the world, things we would do when we got back, all kinds of things, going off to all different places, coming up with ways of utilising technology, publishing this, that and the other. And it's all really good, and it was really inspiring. But what's been really interesting, coming and having our post-ordination retreat just a few weeks ago, is how everybody is actually putting their energy into the basics, and that is having a massive effect. So it doesn't have to be these grand schemes, these grand projects. And one way of exploring that is just to ask, well, what did I connect with? What did I benefit from? What was it that made me stick around? What made me deepen my own practice? And then, of course, how can I offer that to others? How can we offer that to others? So I think we can trust that that's what other people are looking for. That's what we were looking for. That's what we found and connected with. And other people will too. So you'll come up with your own things in groups, I imagine. But I'll just mention two things that have occurred to me. So two things that I've benefited from and which I'd like to pass on to those people who are coming into our Sangha. So the first thing I connected was the clarity of Bhante's teaching. So the clarity of Bhante's presentation of the Dharma. And Padmavajra evoked this in his talk when he spoke of loyalty in terms of deeply understanding Bhante's insight into the Dharma. And that insight is profound. So Bhante has surveyed the whole of Buddhism in its breadth and depth, highlighted its transcendental unity, and has demonstrated that the Dharma is a universal liberating force. And out of that insight, he's lifted this whole system of practice that we have these great principles and practices that actually work in our modern context and in our cultural circumstances. So I think that vision and that understanding is something that we can pass on to others, something that we can offer as a bridge to others. And of course, that means that we have to be clear. We have to be clear about Bante's presentation of the Dharma, not just in theory, but in our own experience as well. And if we can do this, if we can offer this to people, if we can pass that on to people, then we're going to be of great benefit to them, just as this has been benefit, I'm sure, to all of us. So that's one thing. The second thing that I've benefited from and would like to pass on is Kalyanamitrita. It's a spiritual friendship. And of course, that's coming out of Bhante's insight into the Dharma, our emphasis on Kalyanamitrita. So most people who are coming along to our centres are stepping into an unfamiliar environment. So they're probably being driven there by that existential dukkha that I've already mentioned. And there's a certain disorientation, I think, that comes with that. So you see people, don't you, that come to the centre for the first time and they're not quite sure where to look and which direction to look in, and usually end up fixating on the notice board with all the signs on, just to have something to kind of steady themselves with. And it's like that, I think. When we start to explore the Dharma, it is really overwhelming and it's hard to know exactly where to start. And it's a great gain for people to find a friend within the Sangha, somebody that takes an interest in them, begins to forge a friendship with them, a spiritual friendship. It could be the first spiritual friendship that they've had. And I think so much can arise out of that. So there's the, I think it's in the Udana, where the Buddha gives the teaching to Maggia, and he talks about the five conditions that lead to the liberation of the heart. When the heart's release is immature, there are these five conditions. And the first condition he speaks about is the importance of spiritual friendship. And it's out of spiritual friendship, he says, that one is able to learn to live ethically, experience deep communication, energy for the spiritual life is roused, and wisdom emerges. But all of that arises out of spiritual friendship. That's foundational. So if we do befriend people then who are coming into contact with our movement, our Sangha, that's going to be of great benefit. I remember Artapriya once saying to me in a group that our best friend is out there. So the best friend you might ever have in your life is out there, and they haven't found the Dharma yet and they're suffering. And when they meet you, they'll find the Dharma and you will form this friendship. Just always have carried that with me ever since. The next newcomer that you meet, they could be the best friend you'll ever have in your life. The strongest spiritual friendship you'll ever have in your life could be with that person. Okay, so finally then the third level. So the third way in which we can be of benefit to the world. So first of all, I said we can keep the genuine Sangha in being. Secondly, we can offer a bridge to people coming to us. But thirdly, we can also step out. We can also step out into the world. So we're probably having an effect on the world a lot of the time. You know, we go about our daily affairs in different places, different cities, whatever. And we're probably having an effect on people in ways that are not always necessarily obvious. And to give you an example of this, a recent example that I've experienced myself, There were a number of us from the Padmaloka community who went into Norwich just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we were going to see Manju Sia, who's also a member of the community and a member of the ordination team, so a lot of you probably know him. And he's also a novelist, so he's written a couple of novels that have been really well received by all accounts. And he was having this book event in a bookshop in Norwich called The Book Hive, and it's an independent bookshop. And everything, when we got there, everything was set up for Manju Sia. You know, he was centre stage, he had an area with seats all around him. And Henry introduced Manju Sia, spoke about him and his book, you know, really presenting the stage for Manju Sia to walk onto. And when Manju Sia went in front of everybody, he didn't start talking about his book. He didn't start talking about himself. The first thing he did was to rejoice in the merits of Henry, the bookshop owner. And you could see that Henry was just really taken aback by this. And the atmosphere in the room just completely shifted. It was as if the bookshop suddenly became a Buddhist centre. So I think that's just one example of the way we can just take what to us is kind of a cultural norm, rejoicing in merits. Yeah, it really has an effect on people and stirs the world up in a positive way. So there are loads of ways that we do that. I can't possibly go into them, but another thing for the groups, I think, is just to explore that. But one thing I do want to say is about views. So I think a particularly important area in which we can go out into the world and have a big effect is in the area of views. So the suffering that we witness in the world and the actions that are causing that suffering, they're all arising out of underlying wrong views. So if we want to alleviate suffering, if we want to modify the behaviour that causes suffering, what's needed is a radical reformation of views and a real tackling of wrong view. That's what will really change things. And this is the key insight of Dr. Ambedkar, of course, the Dalit leader who instigated the mass Buddhist conversion movement in India. So Ambedkar could see that it's not enough to abolish caste discrimination constitutionally. There had to be a revolution, or a Dharma revolution as he called it, whereby the views out of which oppression arises would be radically altered and reshaped in accordance with the principles of the Dharma. And in our own culture too, we are surrounded by wrong views. So there's a whole host of them, various isms and ideologies. So things like materialism, consumerism, the idea that the more and more we buy, the more and more happy we'll become. Individualism, and even superficial understandings of things like equality. Do we understand what that means? And often the superficial understandings are at odds with some of the things we've been exploring in this retreat. And these wrong views that we encounter in the world, they're often poorly thought through, if at all. They're one-sided, they're often abstract. And they often serve narrow ends, selfish ends even. And that's why they result in so much suffering, not just for the people who are the recipients of actions based on those views, but also the people acting from those views and having those views. So we can step out into the world and be of benefit to the world by challenging wrong view, offering a dharmic perspective. So we can offer right view. And right view in contrast to wrong view, it sees the full picture of experience. Right view sees the impermanence, insubstantiality, unsatisfactoriness of conditioned existence. It offers a gateway to liberation. And it always serves the highest and greatest possible good, which is the ultimate liberation of all beings from suffering. So I can say that. I can say that we can step out into the world and challenge wrong view. But it's really, really difficult, isn't it? It's difficult work. It's difficult because we have to try and avoid self-righteousness. We have to avoid getting embroiled in wars of words whereby we forget the precepts, get drawn into fighting on unethical terms, unethical levels. It's also difficult, and I find this one particularly difficult, because it risks becoming unpopular. So if we challenge views that are predominant in the world, people are not going to like that. Some people are not going to like that. And it's also difficult because it's slow work. So the things we can do to challenge views and reshape views in accordance with the Dharma, we're not necessarily going to see the fruits of our efforts. They might not become visible in our lifetime. But this is the challenge that we're faced with. So this is the challenge that we're faced with if we want to live in accordance with that fourth ordination, acceptance verse. And I think to rise to that challenge, we mustn't forget the other three acceptance verses that we've already looked at during the retreat. So being loyal to our teachers, practicing the teachings, so that we can develop a clear perspective. Working to create a deep harmony within the Sangha, so that we can then step out from that place of harmony, that supportive culture and environment. And we need always to be moving in the direction of enlightenment, developing those five spiritual faculties that Satyaraja talked about last night. So in rising then to the challenge of living for the benefit of all beings, let's not forget those other three acceptance verses. But also, I think, and really crucially, let's not forget that we are not alone in doing this. So we do make a personal commitment. We do make a personal commitment to live for the benefit of all beings. And as I've said, we take that seriously. But we are joining an order. We're joining an order and becoming a hand or a head of the 11-headed, 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. And it's on the basis of our collective endeavours to act for the benefit of all beings in a serious and intelligent way, in a wise and compassionate way. It's on the basis of that that the bodhicitta can arise. And ultimately it's through the force of that, the bodhicitta, mysterious bodhicitta, that the suffering of all beings can be alleviated. So I'll finish there. Thank you.